This is Rob Saylor, Director of the Lilly Endowment Clergy Renewal Programs at Christian Theological Seminary. In our podcast series, we'll be sitting down with folks who have been friends of the program, who have benefited from the programs, or who have wisdom to share for congregations and pastors who are seeking renewal opportunities. We are very much looking forward to hearing their insights and are very glad that you've joined us for this conversation series. Today we'll be talking with Reverend Mike Mather, who is pastor of First United Methodist Church of Boulder, Colorado. Mike has been a recipient of two clergy renewal grants and is a longtime friend and advocate of the program. Mike, it's really a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Rob.
Now, Mike, you've been involved with the clergy renewal programs in multiple ways, most notably, I think, having taken, I believe, two renewal leaves yourself. I wonder if you could just describe a little bit what you did on your renewal leaves, what the congregation did, and then how was it beneficial? What was the impact of that upon you, your family, the congregations? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you did?
Sure. So the first clergy renewal leave was while I was pastor at Broadway Christian Parish, United Methodist Church in South Bend, Indiana. It was 1999 when we applied, and in 2000, we took our clergy renewal leave. In planning for it, I talked with the congregation about some things I'd thought about doing. I had never been to India before, and I'd often thought about going to a place like India. We were a low-income located in a low-income community in South Bend. And I thought going to some place like India where people really didn't have anything would teach me a lot. So I met with the leadership of the congregation. Then we had a congregation-wide meeting. And I said, well, I'd like to go away for 3 months, go to India for a couple months, and then go to the Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. And they said, 3 months isn't enough. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, if you're going to go to India, you need to spend some time there. And then coming back, it's going to be adjustment. We think you need to spend 6 months.
I'm guessing that wasn't the reaction you were exactly expecting.
No. Yeah. And at first it was like, oh, this is great. And then the second was, well, what are they saying? So we began to talk with them some more about it. And in January of 2000, we left and headed off to India and did not come back for 6 more months. I mean, come back to the church. We went to India and we spent India and Bangladesh and spent the next two months there. My wife and I and our two sons, who at the time were 10 and 5 years old. And we traveled around India and Bangladesh. I had no idea of how difficult it would be to travel with children in the third world. And if I knew, yeah. I don't know if I would have done it. And I'm so glad I didn't know. Mm. It was great. Mm. And we spent, those 2.5 months going around and talking with people. You know, we did micro-lending at our church in South Bend, and I knew that there'd been a lot of micro-lending coming out of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, and we went and talked with the people there, and we saw what people were doing in India as well, and I came back with this great question in my head. I had gone there thinking, oh, I'll see how they do micro-lending, and it will teach us about what to do in South Bend, but what I really came away with is, oh, these people just need to make like a dollar a day to survive here, to live. And being there and seeing that made me realize that what I really was bringing back was a question, not an answer. And the question was, this made perfect sense there in India and Bangladesh. What makes perfect sense where we are?
I love that, just because so often I think these renewal leaves, people think, oh, I'm going to go up the mountain and I'm going to come down with these tablets that have the grand answer to ministry in my life. But you're describing coming back down with a question and a focus for future ministry.
That's right. That's fed the last 20 years of my ministry, I would say. So then when we got back after 2 months, we took a week and we drove out to the Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. And we lived at the Ghost Ranch in New Mexico for the next 3 months. Mm. And while we were out there, I talked with a couple of people. One was a winner of the MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner, a woman named Maria Varela, who was not far away from the Ghost Ranch, who had done incredible community development work in a low-income community called Los Ojos in New Mexico, and went and talked to a professor at the University of New Mexico, Luis Small, who'd done good work in the barrios. And we just wanted to learn from them. But the big deal was, of that time, I mean, those conversations were great. But the big deal was, for 3 months, our family ate every meal together. It changed our lives. It changed our relationships, and for the better. I guess it was potentially that it could have gone a different way, but it didn't. It was great. And the boys went to a local public school in New Mexico. We were there in March and April and May. We would go on hikes every morning and hikes every afternoon along in that place. And we would go, when they were out of school, we would go to places like Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon and places around New Mexico, and just spent that time together that we would have never had otherwise. Again, it changed our lives.
You know, that's so striking, because oftentimes when people think of these renewal leaves, for understandable reasons, their minds sort of go to the big ticket items. Oh, I'm going to take this large trip. And that's fine. But what you're describing is that it was actually more settling into a different kind of rhythm, a different kind of daily rhythm with your family, that was one of the most impactful things.
Oh, yeah. Not one of the most, probably the most impactful things. And yes, it continues to feed the relationships we have within our family, and just the goodness of all of that. And I think it made me, as a result of that, not only a better person, a better husband, a better father, but a better pastor as well, paying attention more to what was important, and that sometimes I could get lost in the weeds of the work, I think.
Say more about that, because I know you as someone that regularly likes to kind of step back and reground yourself and refresh your creativity. How does that relate to the day-to-day work of your pastoral work?
Well, before this time, I would every once in a while do something that I called learning journeys, you know, where I would go, I didn't go to conferences much. I would instead go find people who were doing interesting things and go talk with them. During this time, I like turbocharged that.
Yeah.
First in India and Bangladesh, and then talking with these people in New Mexico, and the connections that it built off of that. When I was talking with Maria Varela, the MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner, she's like, oh, you've got to talk to my friend Monsignor Linder in Newark, who's one of the MacArthur folks as well. And so all these things began to make connections for me to talk with people who were doing things and thinking about them in ways that I hadn't thought about before. Back to this thing about coming back with more questions than answers. It kept feeding me the exploration of questions. It gave me more freedom and space to realize I had freedom and space within my daily life and work that I may not have realized as much without that time away.
That's so striking. And meanwhile, your congregation, which had insisted, no, not 3 months, 6 months, you're out having these incredible adventures and experiences. What was it like for them, both during the leave and then afterwards?
The gift that they gave me in supporting this was extraordinary. But also, they've talked about how much they gained from it. So during that time, we had a deacon at our church, a deacon in the United Methodist Church, and her husband, who was a retired United Methodist minister, actually moved into the parsonage and took on the daily pastoral responsibilities. In the meantime, the congregation threw parties. They got together and spent time enjoying each other. I really didn't send back reports or anything from the time in India, in Bangladesh in particular. Yeah, I don't think I sent back any report in New Mexico either, except maybe just, you know, some practical things along the journeys. But hey, what do we do about this question? I mean, maybe there were 3 or 4 things. But during that time, they spent a lot of time just partying. And that was the thing. Was we were a congregation that was so earnest and so serious about yeah. everything. And it was like a sabbatical for us as a congregation in the midst of the sabbatical, the clergy renewal leave for our family.
And there were funds from the grant that allowed for the congregation to do some of those activities. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Both the party when we left and the party when we came back, and throughout it, there were these smaller parties that went on, smaller gatherings. By the way, it wasn't a very large congregation. I think at that time in my time there, I think when I got there, there were 40 people in 1992. And when I left, there were 90. About this time, there were 80. So they would have these smaller groups get together. And as we said, have parties for no apparent reason, just for mutual delight, for being with one another. And again, I felt like I came back to a congregation that was a lot more rested in its own spirit as well. They had not used it to publish a manual do anything but enjoy their life with one another more deeply.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Brigham's book, Sabbath as Resistance and so on. There's something about just sort of pure, non-utilitarian, non-productive delight that is not only countercultural, but it seems intrinsic to the gospel witness in such a way that really does rub against the grain, not only of how society operates, but how a lot of churches operate, right?
That's right. And yes, and it fits very much the ethos of Jesus.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the size of your congregation, because I think that's one of the factors. I mean, people hear stories like yours and they think, wow, that's great. That is extravagant. But that's not for us. Our congregation can't really dream in that sort of direction. And I wonder if in a really broad way, when you think about, okay, a congregation saying, I just don't know if this sort of thing is for us. This is for larger congregations. This is for richer congregations. This is for multi-staff congregations. What advice would you give, or at least what questions would you want to raise for them to consider?
The first thing I would say, Rob, is that I thought that. When I applied, I thought, well, there's not a chance they're going to support this. We're this little place. Nobody's going to pay that much attention to this. I still remember when Gene Smith, who headed up the program in those years, called to tell me that we were going to get this grant, and I burst into tears.
Oh.
I could not believe that this was actually true. I think too often we undervalue ourselves, and by that I'm talking about our congregations, and we think, man, we had a great heyday. But, now we struggle, there's fewer people, it's a difficult time. But we miss the gift that we have right in our hands. And the Clergy Renewal Program was one way, it became a way that just affirmed the people, not only me, but affirmed the people there for who we were as a congregation. And that it was a place doing good ministry and worthy of being supported and invested in.
You're saying that reminds me, I would be remiss if I didn't mention, you recently published a book, the title of which I believe is Having Nothing, Possessing Everything. And it's about this kind of abundance thinking, right? And seeing abundance in situations and in places and in people where we're trained instead to start with deficit. It seems like this, what you're describing, is very much in line with a broader philosophy about ministry and what the church is for.
Yeah. And ecclesiology in a way, right? I mean, and our first week in India, our first few days in India, I went to visit a friend of my father's in the Darvella slum in Mumbai. The Darvella slum has 1 million people living in 1 square mile. And the only streets through it are these narrow paths that just you can walk single file on. And on either side are open sewers. And if you step over the open sewer, you're in somebody's house. But I tell you what I experienced there and saw there more than anything else. And it's almost obscene to talk about it, but was the joy in the life of the people there and the hospitality that people extended to us. And I was like, man, if people here can recognize abundance in the midst of this, what's getting in my way back in India and back in South Bend from seeing it?
That's so powerful. I'd love to wrap up by asking you, okay, so if it's a pastor or a congregation that's really intrigued and excited by this possibility, they're wondering about engaging the application process and the process of designing this dream. Any other bits of advice that you would give or questions that you would invite them to consider?
Well, I have a friend who's a poet, And one of the things she talks about when she talks about writing poetry is she calls it writing from the negative. I know this is going to sound strange a minute, but what she means is write the thing that you don't think anybody will pay attention to. Write the thing that's really in your heart to say and to sing with this. She says a poem always has two authors, the voice of the poet and the voice of the poem. And she would describe the voice of poem as the voice of God. And I think what that congregation did and what later Broadway in Indianapolis did when I had a clergy renewal lead there was imagine something that was working from the negative in the sense of, well, who would want to support something like this? Mm. This seems like a crazy idea. This doesn't seem like the conventional thing. But it was out of the basis of thinking of those things, about dreams I'd had as a child, or about the big issues that were facing us of wealth and inequality and racism in the respective places, the ability to think about that in different ways and to be encouraged to do that was a really important thing for, I think, not only my thought process, but the congregations as a part of that as well.
I love that point. You know, one thing that we as program staff are often asked is, oh, can we see an example of a winning proposal from the past? And for a variety of reasons, the answer is no. But the main reason is the one you're describing, which is the exact set of activities, the exact style, if it's authentic to the place where it came from and the process that created it, that's what makes for a stellar proposal. And if some other congregation were to just try to airlift or carbon copy those same things, it would not be the same kind of leave because it hasn't been the authentic product of the kind of process that you're describing.
We do believe in the incarnation after all.
Oh yeah.
The particular place, the particular body, the particular people, and the way God's spirit works within each of those is so very different.
Mike, it's just always such a pleasure to talk with you. And we certainly wish you, in gratitude from those of us in Indianapolis for the many years of amazing ministry here, and with deep blessings for your new ministry in Colorado. Thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation about clergy renewal. Support for our podcast series comes from Lilly Endowment Incorporated. Our producers are Jessica Mesman and Cassidy Hall. And our theme music is composed by Father Joel David Weir. If you'd like to find out more about clergy renewal, please check out our website at www.lilyclergyrenewal.org, and we look forward to hearing from you.